Hello, Finding Humanity listeners. We have some exciting news to share. Our podcast has just been nominated for the 2022 Webby Awards. The show that you've been supporting since we launched in 2020 has been singled out as one of the 5 best podcasts in the world for public service and activism. But we need your help. The Webby People's Voice Award winners are chosen by listeners like you. Take a minute to vote for Finding Humanity at webbyawards.com. The link is in our show notes and show description. Voting closes on April 21st. Thank you so much for your support.
Women's rights are human rights. As a human being, a woman should enjoy all basic human rights. Women should be given equal rights and equal opportunities, socially and politically, economically. There are good framework, legal framework, political framework, but still we cannot eradicate this violence against women. Then this requires some political will by the political leaders.
I have huge respect for the courage of women who take that first step in seeking access, whether it's because of domestic violence or other forms of violence in the workforce, who wants access to justice, and very often they are failed by our system.
We have many conventions, declarations to prevent crimes against women and crimes against humanity, etc. But it's a matter of political will. The leaders are not united.
You're listening to a special episode of the Finding Humanity podcast with the Elders, a group of leaders brought together by Nelson Mandela. I'm your host, Hazami Bermada, and I am proud to be joined by my co-host, Mary Robinson. Mary is former President of Ireland, former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and Chair of the Elders. Today, Mary and I are honored to be joined by Ban Ki-moon, former Secretary General of the United Nations and Deputy Chair of the Elders. Together, we unpack the issues of violence against women and girls, gender equality, and access to justice. Violence against women and girls is a profound global injustice. It is estimated that 1.3 billion women, which is equivalent to the entire populations of North America and Europe combined, have experienced intimate partner violence or violence by a non-partner at some point in their lives. In this special episode of our Finding Humanity podcast, we explore the solutions to ending violence against women and girls. How does increasing access to justice better safeguard women's rights? Why is feminist leadership vital in not only advancing equality, but also in prohibiting violence and ending discrimination? And how can men play their part in ending violence against women and girls and in challenging misogyny? During his tenure as Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon put equality for girls and women at the top of the United Nations agenda. In 2010, under his historical leadership and direction, the United Nations Agency for Women, or UN Women, was founded.
When I became Secretary General in 2007, I realized that there's a huge imbalance in terms of men and women's standings, social and political standings. In fact, even at this time, as of now, there are more women staff in UN system, about 60% to 40%. But most of the higher ranking, higher status are being taken by men. I was struck to hear that until 1992, that's during the time of Boutros-Ghali, when he became Secretary General in 1992, there were only 3 women at the Under-Secretary General level. So I decided that there should be some change of political will. So I decided to appoint more women, and I really wanted to scout more women to higher positions like Assistant Secretary General. That's why in July 2010, against many resistance and the bureaucratic resistance and the difficulties, I was able to establish UN Women.
As we start talking now about leadership and the role of women and the importance of having women's voices around the table, Mary, how would you define feminist leadership?
Well, first of all, I can attest to the way that Ban Ki-moon did appoint women, because he appointed me to three different positions as special envoy of his to the Great Lakes in Africa, and then later to climate change before Paris, and then in 2016 to El Nino and climate. He was my boss at the time. I'm kind of his boss now as chair of the elders, and he's my deputy. And he's extraordinarily supportive of the fact that I'm his chair and a woman. I can't tell you how much I feel that support on a regular basis. And it's actually really important that a man can feel comfortable being led by a woman. That's very important. On women's leadership, I think on the whole, women lead in a problem-solving, open, inclusive way. They tend to listen more. Most women have some experience of discrimination at some point when they were, you know, making their way, and therefore they have more compassion and more empathy for minorities, for those who are excluded, for those who suffer discrimination, for those who suffer violence against women, and so on. There is that innate sense of empathy and even anger about the situation.
Mr. Ban, you talk often also about being a feminist. Can you tell us a bit more about what feminist leadership means to you?
When I became foreign minister of Korea, there was not a single woman director general. So I picked up Kang Kyung-hwa, you know, who was working as minister counselor at the Korean mission at the United Nations. I just scouted her as a director general. That was my authority, my power. So she was the only female director general. Now she became the first and only female foreign minister in Korean history now. So this is what I became a feminist. It was good for me as a secretary general. I really wanted to do much, much more for gender empowerment. I am glad that we are having more and more women political leaders. I understand that there are at least more than 20 at this time. Mary Robinson was the first female president of Ireland, and she's the leader of the elders now. So there are so many proud and successful female leaders in this world. But frankly speaking, much more needs to be done.
Mary, I wanted to ask you, some people see gender equality as a women's issue. Why do you think that it's also an issue for men?
I think it can be very frustrating when we have discussions on gender equality and most of the audience is women. I think we really need to understand that this is an issue for women and men, men and women, and it actually benefits hugely from the kind of leadership that Ban Ki-moon has been talking about and calling himself a feminist, how important that is, how important it is for countries to have feminist foreign policy and so on. And when men champion, as the elders do, as our male elders do, women's rights, it is hugely supportive and impactful to hear a man speak eloquently about how important it is to him to be surrounded by good female colleagues who bring insights, who bring a diversity of thought, etc. It's really empowering and supportive. When you have a man talk very eloquently about getting rid of violence against women, that is not acceptable, zero tolerance, the He for She campaign that UN Women instituted for heads of state to take a lead, and the many heads of state that have spoken out, that's really important.
And on the topic too, Mr. Ban, you're speaking about how surrounding yourself with powerful female women leaders also makes you a better leader. We're talking also about the role of gender and how that impacts political life. And you've spoken about your upbringing and your mother being your role model. Can you tell us a bit more about the impact that having a powerful mother figure played in your life, specifically when it comes to being willing to be surrounded by powerful women voices?
I was grown up in a very conservative, patriarchal society in Korea. When I was a young boy, Korea was a totally male-dominant society. It is quite strange, But within family, mothers always had a deep influence on their children. But ironically, then all these Korean women, they were favoring baby boys. I have seen so many cases that these women in a very poor countries, they were giving birth to many children until they have a son baby. Traditionally, women, mothers, have been dominant within their families, even though they didn't have any social and political standings. They were not educated. My mother, she was not educated even primary education during her time. She died 2 years ago when she became 100 years. So she was, I believe, quite resilient, very strong-willed. Then most of the Korean women, they were very strong-willed. And they were overcoming all these hardships, poverty, and growing up their children, while men, they were just indifferent to their family domestic affairs. This is something which I, to my mind, strange. My mother, until her last day, became a very strong symbol and a pillar for me spiritually. I think this is what most of the Asian mothers have been really influencing their society, their family. But unfortunately, as I said, when it comes to political and social, economic life, women didn't play much role because they were mostly given some secretarial jobs. And that's the maximum at that time, or even bank clerks.
Well, and Mary, on that, I would like to know what role gender played in your leadership journey.
It's a little bit difficult to say. I was the only girl growing up with four brothers, which gave me a very early interest in human rights and gender equality and using my elbows. So from the beginning, I was determined that I was going to be equal to my brothers, which my parents, who are medical doctors, kept telling me, yes, you have the same opportunities, you'll have the same education, we'll look after that. But Irish society at the time wasn't telling me that. As I grew up, I had to wear a scarf in Catholic church. I couldn't be an altar girl because there weren't any altar girls. It was all altar boys. And, you know, so growing up in a very Catholic Ireland, I was aware of the oppressive nature of some of this and that it wasn't helping links between the two parts of the island, links with Northern Ireland. So as a senator, I fought for removing those discriminatory laws. And as president, I spent a lot of time reaching out and using the words love to those in Northern Ireland, which this was before the Good Friday Agreement. There was still conflict in Northern Ireland. But I wanted to assert, using both feminist and feminine qualities to do so, in that sense that a woman can use a different way of addressing issues.
Feminist leadership is crucial to solving challenges that women face all over the world, including violence against women and girls. Men have a vital role to play as allies. All men, including those who are not violent or abusive, have a responsibility in ending violence against women and girls.
Men have a huge role to play because, after all, they are husbands, they are fathers, they have often more power in community than women do, and they can interact in so many different ways. And it's really important if men in official positions acknowledge that the state itself has a role in preventing violence against women, that there needs to be an official determination to counter violence against women and to do it systematically, if that is, as it is in so many countries, is a real problem. And so women are far more likely to experience gender-based violence than men, but men's use of power over women can be countered by men challenging that and taking their responsibility and speaking out about women having protection, having access to justice, having the supports that are needed, and having the resources that are needed.
Violence against women is a deeply rooted and widely prevalent phenomenon at this time, unfortunately, while we have been really speaking out, trying to root out this violence against women. During my time, I took also this violence against women as one of the very important top priority. There are many ways, this violence against women can be compounded by multiple intersecting inequalities at a broader context of social exclusion and marginalizations. Factors such as race, ethnicity, religion, political and other opinions, national or social origin, property, marital status. So there are so many reasons why this violence against women have been taking place.
Well, I think you both touch on something really important too, which is the role of males in society in creating and perpetuating some of the violence. What are the political, cultural, and societal challenges that we face in actually overcoming and ending violence against women?
So there are deep cultural differences in power, differences in social roles, differences in culture. And we've had, bad, harmful practices that affect girls, such as genital cutting and early child marriage. These are not culture. These are harmful traditional practices. And we have to call them out as such. And, they're within a society that has different roles. And as Ban Ki-moon has said, and, I've also witnessed this, the favoring of the boy child starts a whole process of different treatment and elevating the boy child above the girl. And that's the start of the discrimination and the start of the potential violence. So we have to tackle it. I really have to express a profound sense of literally horror when I became aware of how much rape is used as a method of war. When I was High Commissioner for Human Rights, I made a number of visits to war-torn areas like Goma, for example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and sat and listened to women who were raped to the point where their body was supposed to be destroyed. It wasn't just a sexual act. It was a destruction of the womb of a woman. And it happened over and over again, literally destroying that entity of a woman, destroying her being and causing her awful problems afterwards, having her body to be reconstituted, having, really terrible, terrible problems. And it has happened again and again, the use of rape as a form of war. It's really something that we cannot exaggerate the importance of tackling, and tackling with really good preventive measures and tackling in a way that holds those responsible to account, because it still continues.
And why does it continue, Mr. Ban?
Well, I cannot answer why it continues like this way, but it requires continuous, steady, and very firm way of educating and training people, and let the people know that justice will follow, that there will be punishment. So in the place, in the country where this rule of law, justice system, is well established, then there is a much less lower rate of such crimes. When the government leaders, the head of state, president, or prime minister, ministers, or who are in charge of some administration, when they have such a firm rule of law principle, then there is a much, much better possibility that the human rights can be protected. Sexual violence is a serious violation against human rights. This is a matter of human dignity.
While a strong legal framework is essential, Ban Ki-moon says that we cannot eradicate violence against women without the political will of leaders.
Women's rights are human rights. As a human being, a woman should enjoy all basic human rights. Women should be given equal rights and equal opportunities, socially and politically, economically. Unite to End the Violence Against Women campaign really spread very clear and wide message to the people of the world. I think this may take a longer time than we may expect. With the continuation of this COVID-19 lockdown, I understand that UN Women, the UN organization, UN Women provides update information and support the vital programs that fight shadow there's a pandemic of violence against women during the COVID-19. I hope the United Nations, international organizations, and political leaders, NGOs, will raise their voices continuously. This is the lack of political will by the political leaders, particularly. That I am very sorry to make this kind of sort of a complaint to the global leaders. I've been speaking out to the leaders, please have some global vision and please have a global citizenship. But frankly speaking, I have not seen many global leaders with a global citizenship.
And can I just come in a little bit on the more upbeat side on this issue, even though it's difficult, because we've just had these important forums in Mexico and Paris on generation equality, marking the 25th anniversary of Beijing. And the approach was action coalitions. And we have action coalitions on gender-based violence, economic justice and rights, bodily autonomy and sexual and reproductive health and rights, feminist action for climate justice, which I was very, very involved in, technology and innovation for gender equality, and feminist movements and leadership. And these actions coalitions also have a new source of funding. A lot of money has been committed, which wasn't there before. I think we need great accountability of how this money will be spent. It has to get to the real frontline defenders and real communities that need this support, real prevention of violence against women.
I agree totally with what you said, but I also am emphasizing the importance of the political leaders' role. We have many conventions, declarations to prevent the crimes against women and crimes against humanity, etc. But it's a matter of political will. The leaders are not united.
In a previous episode, Mary and I explored what access to justice looks like in practice with leading international human rights lawyer, Hina Gilani. Here, Mary expands on that and talks about how our current legal systems are failing women and what reforms are needed to ensure adequate access to justice for all.
I've learned what access to justice means globally. I served about 15 years ago or more on the first Commission on Legal Empowerment of the Poor. And we came to the worrying conclusion that about 4 billion people in our world didn't have access to justice. More recently, there was the Global Task Force on Justice, which one of our elders, Hina Gilani, was a co-president of. And I was also very supportive of. And it concluded that 5 billion people don't have effective access to justice. So access to justice is too much seen as access to expensive courts and expensive proceedings, which often are not open to the ordinary woman or man who may need access to justice. I have huge respect for the courage of women who take that first step in seeking access, whether it's because of domestic violence or other forms of violence in the workforce or whatever, and who wants access to justice. And very often they are failed by our system. But, the elders are now very strongly endorsing the recommendations of the task force and seeking to implement and wanting a people-centered approach to justice, which is much more community-based. I remember going with Hina Gilani. We marched in the street in Buenos Aires, and then we had a kind of opportunity to visit two clinics. One was a government-run civil aid clinic, which was good, but the other was a community-based approach to access to justice. And it was so much better because it was run by the community, for the community, understood the community, offered services that were relevant to the community. And you could tell the difference from the service provider approach, which, is better than the individual court system, which sees too few applicants, particularly women. But the community-based is so much more supportive. And I have very strongly supported community-based here in Ireland.
Without access to justice, human rights can easily be abused. I have been very strongly emphasizing that whenever there is a crime, like a violence against women, I've been shouting out that justice will prevail. If not today, tomorrow. If not tomorrow, surely in the near future. That has been my strong message to the perpetrators or potential perpetrators, so that they will listen to such a firm position of the United Nations to ensure justice for all. The national government, particularly the political leaders, president, prime ministers, and justice ministers, or prosecutors, or judges, they should strengthen their national institutions, build the capacity, and train those people responsible positions, so that they will always keep in mind that there is accountability and justice issues.
I agree, Ban Ki-moon, and yet one of the problems is that there is, even before the pandemic, you know, less funding for justice. It was shrinking for 4 years. And that's why the elders are very supportive of a fund for legal empowerment and access to justice. And we know that during COVID, these justice issues have accelerated because people are trapped in homes of domestic violence. The protection is less there. The traditional groups are finding it more difficult.
You're both speaking to something really critical around this idea of the gap in achieving justice. I think there's aspirations. We've seen time and time again that we aspire to have a more equitable and just world and have more equitable access to justice itself. But we do see that very few people today still have access to justice, and we do have an injustice gap. So in your perspective, how do we then address that justice gap with access to justice?
As Mary said, that I think we need to really make these tools for access to justice function. While in the office, I have been really trying to talk to world leaders for fundings, so that the General Assembly normally does not provide the budgets to all these tools, except the ICC, they have their own way. But all these tribunals and systems should be functional, should be funded to be functional. And that's a problem, as Mary has been emphasizing about the fundings. So without funding, you cannot have prosecutors and investigators and judges function their proper role. That is some practical problems. But what I have been arguing and emphasizing in principle is that there should be a political leadership firmly rooted in humanity. Then I think we can solve this one.
And Mary, you know, as this beautiful optimist that you are, I would love if you could share with our listeners, you know, when it seems so daunting, you know, when it just seems like the problems are mounting, we lack political will, we lack funding. What is your message to listeners on how they can actually take action to end inequality?
Well, first of all, I don't call myself an optimist. I call myself a prisoner of hope. I learned that from Archbishop Tutu, the first chair of the elders. But actually, one of the reasons I have for particular hope on this and other issues in our world today is we are seeing more of the centrality of the adolescent girl and the young woman. And this is important. We see it in climate. Look at Greta Thunberg at the age of 15, starting to sit in front of her parliament with her sign, her handmade sign. I noticed her and said, you know, more power to her, but this isn't going to come to anything. Little did I know the power of that. We need young girls and women to step out now and mobilize their communities and insist on the dignity and worth of their lives and those that they are seeking to speak for. You know, more and more and more. And then we will see change happening.
I believe change is possible because we are facing so many problems all around the world. We are facing this pandemic. We are suffering from all this climate crisis. So for all these good institutions and policies and other declarations and our commitment possible, I'm urging again all the political, economic, social, and civil society leaders to raise their voices and praise women's rights at the top of their agenda, as if they were caring for their own daughters or their own wives and their mothers. But I think that is our moral responsibility, political responsibility by the political leaders combined. I think we can make our world better for all. That's our commitment.
Widespread violence against women has significant political, economic, and cultural consequences. The cycle to end this grave injustice must start with us. You have the power to inspire real change. If you'd like to hear more empowering stories from Finding Humanity or to learn more about this episode, visit our website at findinghumanitypodcast.com. Please subscribe, rate, and review our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Your ratings and reviews help Finding Humanity reach new audiences, so we thank you for your support. For more opportunities to engage with us, follow us on social media and subscribe to our newsletter. In our podcast, we cover pressing and at times controversial social and political issues. The views and opinions expressed are those of the interviewees and do not reflect the positions or opinions of the producers or any affiliated organizations. Finding Humanity is a joint production of the Humanity Lab Foundation and Human Group Media. This special series is made possible in part by our collaborating partner, The Elders. For this episode, I'd like to thank our special guests, Mary Robinson and Ban Ki-moon. Our co-executive producers are Camille Lorente and Hazami Bermada. Associate producers are Fernanda Oriegas and Tani Jaraprasok. Policy and background research by Carolina Mindica and Tani Jaraprasok. Mixing, editing, and music by Maverick Aquino. I'm your host, Hazami Bermada. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to seeing you on our next episode.